Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the 2014 Sunstone Salt Lake Symposium. My name is Micah Nicolaisen. I'll be chairing this session. Session number 213, Inventing Tradition, the Lead Plates of Sacromonte and the Gold Plates of the New World, a comparative study. Our main presenter today is Michael G. Reed, who earned his bachelor's and master's in the State College of his home city, California State University, Sacramento. He wrote his master thesis on the development of the LDS Church's attitude toward the cross and published an expanded revision of this thesis through John Whitmer Books entitled Banishing the Cross, the Emergence of a Mormon Taboo. Michael is now working on his doctorate in the history/Christianity program at Graduate Theology Union, Berkeley. Michael will give us his presentation, which should last about 30 minutes or so. Afterwards, we will hear a response from Richard Bushman, who is Governor Moore's Professor of History Emeritus at Columbia University and the Bancroft Award-winning author of numerous books, including Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling. Michael, the time is now yours. Oh, and afterwards, we will open up the audience for question and answer. Quick reminder for everybody to turn off their cell phones. This session is being recorded for posterity. Michael, time is now yours.
You can use that microphone there. Or
okay.
Or
here. Mind if I sit then?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Well, my name is Michael Reed, as you just heard. I've been working on a wide variety of topics. My master's thesis was on Mormons and the cross, where I traced the development of the taboo in Mormon culture. That has since been published as a book. And now I'm moving on to esoteric studies, ritual theory. I'm focusing a lot on Freemasonry and folk magic. But for this presentation, I'm going to be comparing two sets of plates. Can you hear me very well?
No.
Okay. How about now? Hello.
Turn that one on.
All right, I'll just like this.
This one's working now.
So in this paper, I will present a comparative study between the golden plates of the New World and the lead plates of Sacromonte, Granada, Spain. I did a blog article on this a while back, and this is a bit of an expansion on that. And this is still a work in progress also. There's a lot more that I want to do with this. Hopefully, I can convince my advisors for my PhD program to maybe allow me to do this for my dissertation. All right. These two plates, sets of plates. What I plan to do is explore how both of these sets of plates founded traditions for two distinct groups of people who shared similar needs. Okay, so between 1595 and 1599, sounds like the volume went down. Did it go down? Hello?
Might be better up here.
Yeah, maybe you should hop up there. Sorry about this.
Professional electrician.
Okay, so between 1595 and 1599, 22 books of lead were recovered from the hillside of Sacromonte in Granada, Spain. And they were unearthed by treasure seekers, no less. These books were later determined forgeries. But it was not until the middle of the 19th century that most historians arrived to this conclusion. These plates were unearthed after the Moriscos were banished from Granada and forced to settle in France, North Africa, and other areas, including the New World. Moriscos were nominally Catholic. They were Catholic, nominally Catholic descendants of Muslim converts, some of whom developed a hybrid of the two faiths. This amalgamation of Catholicism and Islam is found in the various translations of the lead plates supporting the Immaculate Conception, but reducing Jesus to the status outside the Trinity. It is believed that these documents were forged by the Moriscos, or by Moriscos, certain Moriscos, not only for the purpose of spiritual survival and acceptance, but also to exalt Granada above all the cities in Spain in holiness and antiquity. One set of these plates contains a narrative that I find especially interesting, considering my studies, and I also find it to be reminiscent of aspects related to Mormonism's sacred metallic record, the gold plates. The leaden book, titled A History of Certainty, describes Angel Gabriel visiting Mary in her home and showing her a sacred record, written by the powerful hand with radiant light on circular tablets of precious stones, whose value God alone has knowledge of. Mary then translates the book on leaden plates and seals it with a seal of Solomon, and explains that God had ordered her to do with the plates as was done with the tables of Moses. James, it is said, will bear this copy to the uttermost quarters of the earth, and there he will conceal a spot where God shall guard it. There the sacred record where it was taken would remain under Gabriel's protection until the heresies and offenses of the world should need the application of the remedy. That those offenses and heresies would be disclosed by the hand of a holy priest. God will raise up a lowly creature who shall explain the certainty of the Gospels in the light of the Holy Ghost. And we're still talking about the lead plates, not the gold plates. It goes on. Okay, so when all are satisfied, their law shall become a single law, and error and impiety shall be banished from the world. Mary then gives the tablets, the lead tablets, to Apostle James, saying, "Go with this copy of the tablets of the certainty, and with this book unto the ends of the seashore. God shall provide thee with a little boat, whose pilot shall be the angel of God. When ye arrive in Spain, hide the book and tablets where a dead man comes to life." James did as instructed, and as soon as he landed on the shores of Spain and laid the book of the tablets on the ground, the earth began to gape, and from it came a man who said, "Why hast thou raised me from my tomb, wherein I rested since the time of Moses?" The story ends with James taking these lead documents, and then he records his own history on the plates about what had just taken place, and then deposits all of the records into a cave to wait until this great high priest shall arise and find them. Additionally, in the certainty of the gospel, Peter asks the Virgin Mary, says, "Our Lady, speak to us about the virtues of the Arabs." These refer to the Moriscos I was previously talking about. "The virtues of the Arabs, who will defend our religion with the truth of the Gospels in times to come, and their rewards and their superiority of their tongues." Mary replies, "The Arabs will be the defenders of our religion in times to come. And the superiority of their language over others is like the domination of the sun over the stars of the sky. God chooses them for this and granted them victory." From the same book, she insists further, "I say to you that the Arabs are called, or are one of the most excellent of peoples, and their language one of those the most excellent of languages. God chose them to help him support his religion in the last days, after they had been its great enemies. And to that end, God gave them power and judgment and wisdom, because God, through his mercy, chooses among his servants whom he wills. So just considering a portion of one of these lead books, I mentioned there's 22 of them, right? And this is just a portion of this one. We observe very striking parallels with the gold plates narrative. I'm sure I've picked up some on your own. But to list a few out, both were metallic records. Both were said to have been written in by multiple authors, passed from one to the other. Both were inscribed on them in unique characters and language. The lead plates were written in Arabic, Spanish, and Latin. The gold plates, a combination of Egyptian and Hebrew. Computer's freezing it. Okay. Both express high regard for pure ancestral language. Both books, or both records, were sealed. Both were discovered by treasure seekers. Both were deposited in the earth where the dead would rise. Both describe disciples called by God to travel to another land by boat, and that this would be assisted through divine guidance. Both asserted that the ancestors of these indigenous people were Christian, or had become Christian. Both records revered the indigenous people as chosen. Both prophesied that the indigenous people would fight on the side of the Lord's religion. Both records prophesy that they would be found and explained by people of humble circumstance. Some people have written about this, about the non-believing scholars say that, yeah, Joseph Smith prophesied of himself by implanting his passages. In regards to the lead plates of Sacramento, Granada, Spain, that's the case believed for these plates, that those who were involved in the forgeries were prophesying of themselves and how they will be instrumental in bringing these truths to light. Okay. Both prophesied that these records would be unearthed during times of religious turmoil. Both claimed that these records would be instrumental in bringing people out of apostasy. Both provided a sacred history. This, I guess, I think is especially important. Both records provided a sacred history for the lands from which they were found. And also important, both records legitimized the presence of indigenous people in their lands. Like the Moriscos had experienced in Granada, Spain, American Indians were confronted with forced or strongly coerced conversion and would soon be run off their lands and finally pushed west across the Mississippi following the Indian Removal Act in May 28, 1830, which is just 2 months after the Book of Mormon was published. I say finally because concern for the American Indians began long before 1830. Spanish settlers of the New World compared the American Indian problem to the struggles that they had with the Morisco problem in Spain. Bartholomew Hernandez expressed such in a letter to Juan de Obando. And he asserts that New World Indians, like the Moors of Granada, were merely Christian in name and exterior ceremony, while on the interior, they have no concept of the things of our faith. So if people are concerned with, I guess, well, what you would call a traditionalization has to do with more than just myth-making. but it also has to do with developing a people that would include rituals and customs and costumes and things like that. Now, the external ceremony, you're saying, isn't really a problem for these converted Indians. Because the problem is that they don't know if they're truly converted in the heart. Are they actually having a true conversion? Or is this just an outward sign? Or are they crypto-Muslims still? This was a concern for both the Native Americans and the Mestizos by the Spanish. Okay. Scholar Eric Hobsbawm has noted in his study of the invention tradition that tradition invention tended to occur more frequently when rapid transformation of society weakens or destroys the social patterns for which old traditions has been designed. It is clear, says Hobsbawm, that plenty of political institutions, ideological movements and groups, not least nationalism, were so unprecedented that even historic continuity had to be invented. For example, by creating an ancient past beyond effective historical continuity, either by semi-fiction or by forgery. With this focus, a scholar, Hugh Trevor Roper, studied the Highland traditions of Scotland and a cultural revolt against Ireland. And I'm going to be using a lot of this material here. There was the artificial creation of the Highland traditions presented as ancient, original, and distinctive. There was the process by which these new traditions were offered to and adapted by historic lowland Scots. Two distinct acts of bold forgery created an indigenous literature for Celtic Scotland and, as a necessary support to it, a new history. In so doing, they put Scottish history on the map. Before 1745, the Highlanders had been despised as idle predatory barbarians. In 1795, they had been feared as dangerous rebels. But after 1746, when their distinct society crumbled so easily, they combined the romance of a primitive people with the charm of an endangered species. The result was the invention of a Scottish pedigree, produced and distributed in a series of fraudulent manuscripts. One manuscript was said to have been carefully collated with a second manuscript recently discovered by an unnamed Irish monk in a Spanish monastery, unfortunately since dissolved. And another manuscript, recently in the possession of Lord Lovat, was also cited, although it had also, or it all, had unfortunately been carried away to America and therefore lost, but they were claiming to be actively seeking for it still. Certain frauds even went so far as to explicitly claim royal bloodlines. They did this in a series of short stories, for this example. Under romantic but transparent names, professed to reveal historic truth. It was claimed that such figures were seeking to restore its ancient society, customs, and costumes. The invention of tradition imagined a golden age in the past of the Celtic Highlands. They created literary ghosts, forged texts, and falsified history in support of their theories. Again, invention of tradition was not an uncommon phenomenon. Chris Morgan studied the hunt for the Welsh past in the Romantic period, which occurred around the turn of the 19th century. The Welsh were becoming like the English. There was concern for the decay and demise of the ancient way of life in Wales. This triggered an unprecedented outburst of interest in things Welsh and highly self-conscious activity to preserve or develop them. In this period, Welsh scholars and patriots rediscovered the past, historical, linguistic, and literature traditions, and where those traditions were inadequate, they created a past that didn't exist. So a Welshman of the period named Edward Williams assumed the bardic pseudonym Yilo. And he was not only an able man of letters and antiquity, but was also a romantic mythologist who rolled into one many 18th century dreams and fashions, fads and fancies. Yilo was obsessively concerned with myth and history. And out of 18th century interest in Druidism, he created the notion that the Welsh bards had been the heirs of the ancient Druids and had inherited their rites and rituals, their religion and mythology. He claimed that he and his friend Edward Evan were the last remaining bards who came from this Druidic apostolic succession. Yilo set various cells of bards all over Wales and gave them a set of rituals, liturgy, and ceremony, and set about creating a Druidic corpus of lore for them until his death in 1826. I'm still relying on his research. This was to be the revival of the Bardic Order, to be a national cultural institution for Wales. One of the most extraordinary of the new heroes was Marduk, the son of Prince Ogwan, Ved-Ven-Ned, who was disheartened by the quarrels at home in North Wales, and he left on his ship for uncharted western seas about the year 1770, according to this legend, and discovered America. He returned to Wales, gathered some companions, set sail again with them, and never returned. His descendants were assumed to have intermarried with the Indians and to be still alive in the Wild West. The legend was not of 18th century origin, but had first been used by the Tudors to undermine Spanish claims to rule North America. Yilo forged all sorts of documents to prove that Marduk, this hero, that his descendants were alive and Welsh-speaking somewhere in the Midwest. He was responsible for turning many obscure figures into national heroes. By and by, the 1820s and 1830s were many of these... there were many of these myth-makers to be found in Wales besides Yilo. By Yilo's death, place was taken fresh by myth-makers and creators of traditions, those of radical and nonconformist Wales. The huntsman had changed, but the hunt went on. Okay. So let's go back for a moment to the parallels listed between the lead plates and the gold plates. You may have noticed that I didn't include the claim both were forgeries produced by pious frauds. Although many here may believe this to be the case, for the gold plates and Joseph Smith, I remain unsettled on this matter.
How much time do we have? 10 more minutes? Okay. Thanks.
All right. Consider that Joseph Smith was known to translate a pure hoax that was intended to expose gullibility. Most of us likely already know that Joseph Smith was fooled by the unearthed Kinderhook plates, in which he attempted to translate its inscribed characters. In 1936, back up a little bit. The Kinderhook plates, can you really say that what he had produced is a result of his actions as a pious fraud? You can't really, right? Because he wasn't the one that was the fraud. He was fooled by a fraud. He actually engaged in. Don has done some research on this. And he has shown that Joseph Smith actually referred to the Curtin and Egyptian papers to help him to figure out what the plates meant. So you can't really say that he was, had fraudulent intentions here. And that's the point I'm making. Most of us likely already know that Joseph Smith, you already know because I already told you. But moving on. In 1936, here's another example, was discovered a fraudulent brass plate. Chiseled into this plate was a recording of the landing of Francis Drake in Northern California, supposedly, in 1579. This inscription seemed to confirm previous reports contemporaneous to Drake. Shortly after the announcement of the find, the plate was purchased for $3,500 and donated to my hometown and homeschool, UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. The plate was tested with by an electrochemist professor from Columbia University in 1938 and declared, "It is our opinion that the brass plate examined by us is the genuine Drake plate." That's their conclusion. But decades later, in preparation of the 400th anniversary of Drake's landing, the plate was discovered to be a forgery. When it was retested by the Berkeley professor and director of Bancroft Library, this plate was intended to serve actually as a practical joke. It was intended to fool an initiate into the E. Clampus Victus. It's a quasi-Masonic organization that existed and developed in the Gold Rush in California.
Still exists, Mike. I remember.
Are you really? So you know all about this, right? Yeah. Or exists, yeah. It wasn't until 2002, though, that's quite late, right, that historians were fully able to piece together the story of how this practical joke spun out of control and consequence of the discovered plate being unrecognized by the Clamper initiate and was discarded in 1933. So I guess he had found it in the back of his truck, didn't really understand the significance of it, and tossed it out. Now, 3 years later, it was discovered by another person wandering along who had stumbled upon it, and after which it was sold and donated to the Bancroft Library and remained on display there until 2005. Interestingly, when the discovery of the Drake plate was unannounced, the Clampers were reluctant to step forward for fear of the embarrassment that would be the result of it. However, a year later, after the brass plate was donated to the Bancroft Library, the Clampers published a small book as a spoof, and the title kind of says it all. Ye preposterous book of brass, which includes diverse strange, surprising the Tuscan voyages, learned discourses, pious anecdotes, missionary pilgrims, merry tales, and history, and a full and complete history of ye plate of brass set upon our fair shores by ye ancient buccaneer Frank Drake. All right. They had quite a sense of humor. The Clampers didn't, and still do, right? I hear. After exposing evidence against their forgery in this book, the Clampers declared, "We should now reclaim the plate as the rightful property of our ancient order." However, this request fell on deaf ears. These examples that I just described raise two possibilities to consider in regards to Joseph Smith and the gold plates. Was Joseph tricked by a hoax? Perhaps. If so, this would then remove the fraud from the pious fraud theory. another possibility remains. Perhaps Joseph Smith was like this guy who found the metal plate, on the hillside, right? This Francis Drake plate. But he was like that. It was still an unauthentic document, but it wasn't real. Yeah, it wasn't real, and maybe it wasn't what he thought it was. And so, if this were the case, that Joseph Smith nevertheless actively engaged its characters, just as he did with the Book of Abraham, the papyrus, right? It's been translated. We know it's not the Book of Abraham text. And so as a result of that, Latter-day Saints today are saying, well, that's okay. What Joseph Smith had for the papyrus is actually a catalyst. It served as a catalyst for inspiration. The revelation still came from God. Maybe he didn't actually get those words through an actual translation, as we would call consider a translation to be today. Maybe Joseph Smith could have done the same thing for a set of plates that he had somehow received without understanding what it really was. Okay. So what was it? Maybe it was an ancient record of an ancient people. But Terrell Gibbons has explained that in referencing the characters manuscript, which is falsely being called the Anton manuscript, because it may have served some similar purpose. It's a transcription of some of the characters that were allegedly on plates. Terrell Gibbons speaks of this and talks about how these characters that are on the transcript have been described as everything from Phoenician writing to Mayan scripts to occult symbols, from a Nubian corruption of Egyptian to a secret Masonic code. A through C are options that he says. I guess there's one too, but I think we also have an all of the above option. Perhaps an all of the above option can apply here. But I argue that it is I argue that it isn't necessary to conclude that we must settle with one and one only. Scholars of esoteric studies have long since understood that it was not unheard of for esotericists, and including Masons, to use a wide variety of characters for encoding the text. Moreover, it's extremely common for those of the early modern period to interpret ancient literature and artifacts in creative ways that conformed to and developed their own cultural, political, and religious worldview. So, I mean, there's tons of documents during Joseph Smith's day of Masons turning to ancient Egyptian ruins and seeing Egyptian rituals. But, you know, it wasn't just Masons that were doing this either. Same thing was done with Native American ritual. There were parallels that were being drawn with some of their practices. Some people thought maybe they were the lost tribes of Israel. This was evidence of that. Again, fraudulent documents have been produced and rediscovered throughout history. I only covered a few. Often these were produced during times of great and religious turmoil, and there was a need for them. The discovery of such forged documents facilitated reformative changes that might have otherwise been difficult to justify. Case in point, the Book of Deuteronomy. According to the broad view of scholars, it was the Book of the Law, or the Book of the Commandment, and it was allegedly discovered at the time of the temple's renovation. but that this was actually a fraudulent document that was produced. It was produced to justify King Josiah's reforms, which were then underway. Now, the Book of the Law had a major place in Masonic ritual and Masonic ritual, including acting out of the search for the long-lost Book of the Law. And Joseph's discovery of the gold plates seems to have been at least partially understood in this context. Incidentally, Joseph's father reportedly described the plates as having Masonic symbols on them. Also interesting, I think. Noteworthy may also be that in 1805, scholars were just beginning to suspect the Book of Deuteronomy to be fraudulent. Now think about that. If the Book of Deuteronomy, which is scripture, was considered to be fraudulent, and a means to bring about religious change, and Joseph Smith knew something about it, that fact, It could justify, I think, the pious fraud intention. But again, I'm not necessarily suggesting that that's what happened. But it's something to consider, I think. All right. So there are indeed countless frauds in Smith's day. And I have a book over here, actually a few books that catalog these and describe both the artifacts and their discovery and their significance. But yeah, there are many, many, many examples. Mentioned in books like Fantastic Archaeology. And there are also just frauds in general who are involved in mesmerism, spiritualism, treasure seeking even. But you know, Dan Vogel, he suggests that Joseph Smith may have, or he comes heavily on the side that Joseph Smith did produce plates. I don't think that's a necessary conclusion, even for somebody who might reject the historicity of the gold plates. But now, Dan Vogel, to his credit, he mentions that the Cooper shop on the Smith family's property would have provided Joseph Smith the location and the tools that he needed to produce the plates. As for the material, sheets of tin was inexpensive and readily available. And one can say that tin was the Tupperware of the 19th century, in fact. While some LDS scholars insist that the plates existed and what Joseph Smith and that was what Joseph Smith claimed to be. That Joseph Smith, that there are some that say that Joseph Smith actually fabricated them himself, hence the pious fraud theory. I propose another possibility that I've already alluded to. That Joseph Smith found a metal record that he believed to be what it was not. And in much the same way as he produced the Book of Abraham narrative from the Egyptian papyrus, the gold plates would have similarly served as a catalyst. I suggest that Joseph Smith may have indeed found the metal record, but that this was a Masonic prop, perhaps buried to protect them from anti-Masonic mobs that were then being ransacked at the time, the very time. So I found accounts where these are being carried together, the props and the records, as the mobs are coming in to destroy the lodges. Freaking out, right? What are we going to do with it? We can't send it back to the lodge right now, to the Grand Lodge, like we're supposed to. So what do? They hide them. And where do you hide them? Well, where's the common place to hide things? In the ground, right? Where did Joseph Smith hide the plates? He, of course, hid them in, many different areas, but he occasionally buried them to hide them. It's just what people do back then. So I suggest that Joseph Smith may have indeed found the metal record, but that this was a Masonic prop, perhaps buried to protect them from anti-Masonic mobs that had been ransacking Masonic lodges during that period. It is worthy to mention that some props, or furniture as they are called by Masons, would have included objects like swords and breastplates, also found allegedly with the plates. If this is what Joseph Smith discovered, then this would eliminate the fraud from the pious fraud theory. Objects representing the Book of the Law were used in Masonic ritual. And moreover, I presented a few years ago in Richard Bushman's seminar about the notion of ancient metal records. It was commonly believed in Smith's day that ancient records were often engraved on metal plates. Very, very common. In magazines, newspapers, encyclopedias, and all that. Thank you.
I hope that Michael's dissertation director recognizes the merits of his work and that this is something exciting, it's original, it's brings to light material that we're not altogether familiar with. Made really a number of interesting arguments. The first part of his talk, and I assume this would enter into his dissertation in time, talked about two sets of plates, one for America and one for Spain, where two kind of marginal peoples, the Moors of Spain and the Indians of North America, are given a tradition, and talks about the similarities between those two sets of plates, and then launches into sort of the theoretical frame that in the 19th century, the invention of tradition was very common. All those things that we connect with the Scots, like their bagpipes and their food and their tartans, were inventions trying to create a basis for the Scottish people, the same with the Welsh. Same thing is true for Christmas, the idea of Christmas being a pagan holiday that marked the change of the through the winter solstice. All of that is a 19th century creation. And so these two sets of plates fit into a project that's fairly commonplace through Western civilization, Europe and America in those times. So those are, I think, the two scholarly parts that would fit well into a dissertation. And then Michael launches into a question that's more relevant for us here, and that is the question of fraud. What does it mean for something to be fraudulent in this invention of tradition? And tries to make the case that there's some middle ground between the plates being an actual historical record and them being a deceitful connivance of Joseph Smith's to deceive his followers. All of that, I think, is very interesting. It's interesting, I think, generally, and certainly interesting in the context of Sunstone. I was interested in it because of an experience I had 2 or 3 years ago. I'd been advertising the fact that I was working on the cultural history of the gold plates, and my cousin visited me one day and presented me with a big stack of papers which he had prepared. And after this experience with her, I wrote down notes to describe what had happened. Today my cousin brought me a folder of material on plates of lead found in the Sacromonte caves near Granada around 1595. She heard of them while she and her husband were mission presidents in Barcelona around 2000. She began investigating them at the time and since has put a great deal of work into obtaining further information and translating the Spanish transcriptions of the original Latin transcriptions. The plates claim to be the writing of the Apostle James and others while he was in Spain in the first century. Scholars have tended to judge them as Moorish attempts to meld Christianity and Islam at a later date. She thinks they are legitimate. And for 4 years, spent a couple of hours a day translating the 16th century Spanish. She was attracted initially to the plates because they were religious writings on metal plates that had been discovered in a mountainside, all of the resonances that Michael mentions. However, as she got deep into her studies, she began to fit them into broader gospel themes. She believes they depict the primitive gospel as it was taught by James over against later apostate teachings of the Catholics. She thinks the Catholic Church has suppressed them because they differ from current Catholic teachings. She also sees them as an example of the further records promised in the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants. Thus, they play a part in various narratives coming out of her Mormon views of history. And then she went on to say that she'd even mentioned this to President Monson on some occasion, and Dr. William Hamlin, who's the scholar at BYU who studies plates all over the world, has written articles on all these plates. So there you have another encounter with these unusual lead plates. Well, Michael's at one end of the spectrum of sophistication and learning. My cousin was at the other end of the spectrum, naive wonder at finding these things. But they do share one thing in common, and that is this Mormon fascination with metal plates. A few years ago, Claudia and I were walking through the Asian collections at the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena, and she was a few steps ahead of me, and she turned around and said, "Gold plate." And there, in a little case, was a gold plate about that size, size of Joseph's gold plates, and there was embossed with a Buddha figure. And of course, I went up and had to take a picture of this gold plate. Just last year, we were wandering around the Metropolitan Museum in New York City in the Central American exhibitions, and there was a whole case full of gold plates, in about 2 millimeters thick, very, very thin, and inscribed with very fine characters. Of course, I had to take pictures of them. We went to the library and studied up about them. And that is typical. What I'm trying to say is that this luminous story of a boy finding gold plates carves out a niche in the Mormon mind for writing on metal plates. And wherever Mormons go and they sort of stumble onto one of these things, it sets off a light in their minds. It sort of excites them. Partly, of course, it's because they feel like in some way that this confirms the Joseph Smith's story about finding a gold plate. But what it indicates is that the Mormon idea of history is not just focused in this little area where Joseph Smith lived, but it's scattered in small fragments all over the world. Once people heard I was writing this book on the gold plates, they would write me, "You would be interested in the gold plate I saw in Seoul, South Korea, in the museum." Or I got something about in Bulgaria, there are plates in the museum. So Mormons are taking note of all those things and sort of assembling them into this history that's sort of blurry. They don't know quite what it all means, but somehow all of those metal plates with writing on them belong to Mormons. And they sort of grab them. And what I'm saying is that Michael is at a very learned level and sophisticated level, is participating in that same project. The second observation I have about the setting for what Michael is doing, is to link him with a scholar who's written an article on the gold plates named Ann Taves. Ann Taves now teaches at the University of Santa Barbara, one of the most distinguished historians of American religion, and now practicing, very, very top of the profession, who recently wrote an essay on Joseph Smith's gold plates. And I'm going to tell you what the argument of it is, but let me tell you the moral framework out of which her argument comes. She's very friendly to Mormons. She taught at Claremont Graduate University at the time when you're contemplating a Mormon studies program there, for which later money was raised. Claudia and I went down and taught in that program for a few years. It's still in existence. It's an endowed chair. She was the guiding light. She was the moving spirit behind that whole effort. She's non-Mormon. She likes Mormons. And that puts her in a very interesting position, which a number of scholars of American religion are now in. Namely, there's an incongruity in scoffing about Joseph Smith, because they've known Mormon scholars, they like Mormon scholars, they admire Mormon scholars' work, they think of them as rational people, and to simply dismiss Joseph Smith is a fraud, puts him in a difficult ethical position. In Ann Taves' case, she has two minds. One is highly secular. She's really trying to understand religion from a psychological, sociological point of view. And the other is deeply religious. I think she's Catholic herself. She has a chair of Catholic studies at Santa Barbara. And respects religious experience. And she does not want to depict Joseph Smith as a charlatan. So she's making an effort to find a way to explain those plates. And that's the hardest thing for these people to do. Because if Joseph Smith just saw God or an angel, that's easily explained. Lots of people see God or an angel. He's a visionary. That's a category we understand. But as soon as he says, "I have plates," it's like a beggar saying, "I have a diamond in my pocket, but I'm not going to show it to you." There's something deceitful about that. And the problem is, how do you put Joseph Smith, how do you establish Joseph Smith's sincerity, that he really believed what he wants to do? She makes an interesting argument. She argues that there's a kind of a materialized spirituality, that is, where spirituality leads you to believe there's a material embodiment of the spirit. For example, is transubstantiation. What is the wafer? Is it the flesh of Christ, or is it just a wafer? And for a Catholic, they can perfectly sincerely say it's essentially the flesh of Christ. That's not deceit, that's not fraud, it's what they believe. And Ann Taves is trying to make the argument that's true of the gold plates. Whatever Joseph Smith had, whether in his imagination or tin plates or whatever, his religious, spiritual mentality led him to say, these are the ancient records of the Nephites. Well, I hope, Michael, that you can see there is a parallel.
It's close.
You're trying to say Joseph Smith was not a fraud. You want to remove that. He's pious. And out of his piety, he chose this attempt and effort to create a religious record. So I think that's the company that Michael's in, and it's a very interesting moment when that becomes part of the agenda of very serious scholars like Ann Taves and Michael Reeves. So the question in my mind is, does he succeed at this? He would be the first to admit we don't really have the evidence to pass a judgment. He's presenting this as a hypothesis, as a way of thinking about it. And Taves has not really been accepted by Mormon scholars. It's ingenious, but not entirely persuasive. It's a good faith effort to give Joseph Smith some standing as a genuine religious figure. So I think one of the questions for Michael is how will this go down among Mormon scholars and among his Mormon brothers and sisters? Can he talk about this in high priest group meeting? And how will they receive it there? I think he knows it'd be a hard sell. But I will say this. We live in two places, Provo in the summer, New York in the winter. And in Provo, high priest group, we'd have trouble. In Manhattan, I think people would like it. As I say, in New York, we have all the questions. In Provo, they have all the answers. So, I wish you well with your theory.
Thank you, Michael and Richard. We got about 4 minutes or so for questions, so if anybody wants to come up.
Let me see if these mics are working.
You know, I wouldn't have trouble not accepting Joseph Smith as a fraud, except for the fact that exactly the same time that he claimed that he found these plates, and, you know, I'm one that that thinks they were probably, he probably had some plates, but I don't believe they were gold plates. But he was telling everybody it was his job running around trying to find golden treasure. He told people he knew how to find it. He went through all kinds of incantations and procedures telling people that he could find this treasure. He was telling people that he knew when they could plant their crops. All of this leads to me to believe that he indeed was a fraud.
Thank you. That is a good point. He definitely did have plenty of treasure-seeking activity, as well as associates that were around him. However, we do know that treasure seekers, in their activities for searching treasure, found things. Maybe not gold or anything else. Sometimes they saw things that they weren't expecting.
He could also look in a hat at rocks, claiming
right.
He could see where things were
right.
there.
And that was common.
This leads me to believe that he wasn't really an authentic individual.
Yeah. And people also, you know, mainstream, I guess Protestants in the day would ring bells because they believe that the evil spirits that were driving the storms, right? There's this belief if you ring the bell that you push the evil spirits away. That's why you have the church bells. That's where it came from. But it sounds very strange to us today. But as far as treasure seeking, as far as those that were involved in treasure seeking, that's what they did. Joseph Smith wasn't the only one to put his face in a hat and look at a stone.
In the Apocrypha, there's wild stories that didn't really make it into the New Testament or whatever because they were just too goofy. You listed some hits between the two books where there are similarities and similar themes. The ones that there were the misses, were they just boring things they didn't bother to mention, or were there some similarities that were bizarrely different?
You know, to be honest, I haven't explored the plates well enough to know how different they are. There are some differences. In some areas where some people believe that Immaculate Conception was being promoted, I guess that would be different from what ministry
was. A lot of they're vastly different in the story they tell. One's about the New World and Indians, and the other is about the Moors.
Right, in that way, yeah.
Yes, I study significantly ancient Ireland and Scotland and Wales area. So you mentioned Wales. Have you ever studied or done veracity on the concept of the Leah Fail in Ireland, which is the coronation stone, a.k.a. the Stone of Bethel, Jeremiah bringing it to Ireland with Prince Harriman and Princess Tia from Zedekiah's daughter, this and that. Have you ever come across in ancient Israel, in ancient Ireland, about the Leah Fail?
It doesn't ring a bell for me. I have a ton of material for a wide variety of things. Unfortunately, I also have a bad memory.
Okay.
And so I have to go back to maybe even my dissertation is in print. I will have a better memory by then.
I wanted to comment about issues of authenticity and whether we can look at activities that Joseph was engaged in from a little bit of a different perspective. My own background, of course, is Freemasonry. I'm doing a book on that subject. And it seems to me that you hinted at something that you did not say, and that is this idea of culture building or empire building and its relationship to the record, right? There's a Masonic activity that's related to this.
Right, right.
Right? Masonic utopianism. One thing we can do with the Mormon experiment is we can frame it in Masonic terms and see it as maybe this last great flowering of a certain kind of Masonic tradition, mm-hmm. right? Post-Morgan. We don't see that happening a lot. But Masonic utopianism begins in the 17th century. And there's one way of looking at Mormonism as a flowering of this kind of Masonic utopian ideal that involves politics, that involves economics, you know, to make people equal, right? And it certainly involves spirituality. You also know, and did not say, that the treasure-seeking activities that we see in upstate New York and elsewhere have a Masonic quality to them, too. The idea of seeking out a treasure and finding it is related specifically to the Royal Arch, which is one of Joseph Smith's Masonic preoccupations. And the record that you're talking about, of course, right, where you bury things, right. It isn't just Masonic records that get buried.
Right.
But we're talking about records pertaining to the Royal Arch, which has to do with the Book of the Law, long lost, now found, holiness to the Lord. And that record is a keystone, a keystone. And the actual ritual involves the wrenching of a keystone, which represents Scripture. Right? So all of these things, and you could go on and on about this, arguing that there is an authenticity to what Joseph Smith is doing, even if you say he puts his head in a hat.
And that's, looks at rocks.
And looks at rocks.
And claims that he knows and sees where the treasure is buried.
Certainly. There is still this ring of authenticity to a tradition that Joseph Smith, his entire family, had been engaged in. And I want to point that out. The other observation, and you didn't mention this either, but the words Sacromonte are like, what is it? Isn't that holy mountain or sacred hill?
Right. Right.
Sacromonte, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that a record is found in Sacromonte itself kind of rings to that tradition, even if it's fraudulent, you know? I want to thank you for that. I'd like to also hear, I'm not just here to like set up, my question was about that. How do you see this connecting with Masonic utopianism, Joseph Smith's activities in upstate New York? Can you comment on that? Can you comment more on the idea of the discovery of a specific kind of a record? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Great questions. You know, I guess related to that, I'm thinking about the turmoil that Joseph Smith's own family is having to deal with. Religious turmoil. His father, or at least his brother, was a Mason. And the churches were telling people to choose the lodge or the church. You can't have both. And so this caused a rift in the family. His brother, Hiram, was named after the hero of Freemasonry, Hiram Abiff. So it seemed to be something very important to the family and for the churches to stand out against Freemasonry the way they did. I'm sure it would have caused concern for Joseph Smith and therefore would have triggered a utopian philosophy of his own in regards to bringing his family together. And if just the family, maybe all this other religious turmoil that I'm seeing right here can be helped as well. I guess that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, we're 5 minutes over. Thank you, Michael Reed and Richard Bushman.